Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, there's, in all the Sarah Palin coverage, there's all this sturm und drang, on frankly, on both sides, about, you know, is she too wacky a fundamentalist? Is she just, you know, wonderful and religious? Is she, you know, a member of the Independence Party in Alaska? No, she's not. She just gave the, you know, a video welcome to the to a group that's beloved in the state. You know, on and on it goes. It seems to me that much of this, if not most of it, and frankly, one of the reasons that I haven't spent a lot of time digging deep into it, is a huge distraction from the larger issue. And they're basically two larger issues. Politically, the larger issue is whether or not a McCain-Palin administration will be an extension of a Bush-Cheney administration. But I think the even larger issue than that is the public discourse about the future of this country, about the nature of this country, about the nature of what some would call democracy, what some would call a republic, what I think we can accurately say is a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. If you want to parse James Madison's reinvention of the word republic and the word democracy back in 1788 in the Federalist Papers, and what, you know, what these issues really are, what do conservatives really stand for? Who are they really? What's their worldview? What do liberals really stand for? Who are they? What's their worldview? David Horowitz is with me, and HorowitzFreedomCenter.org, his website, and David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
David, you are the master of gotcha debating, and I'm pretty damn good at it. And I think that what I'd like to do for the purposes of this conversation, if you're up for it, is let's try to set that aside for a minute and have a kind of a no talking point zone, but just a candid and honest conversation about our respective worldviews without demonizing each other, if we can do that.
I think that's terrific, Tom. And, of course, both of us will get hammered if we try to say what the left thinks and what conservatives think, because there'll always be a conservative or a leftist or 10 or 100 of them that'll say, I don't think that way.
Yeah, but the nice thing is that neither you nor I are all that concerned about it being hammered, because it happens to both of us on a daily basis.
Exactly,
anyway.
Exactly. So, right. You have to be in the zone to understand.
So I
actually have written quite a bit about this. I wrote a book called The Politics of Bad Faith, in which I tried to, it's when I was first coming out of the left. And of course, because I've been in the left, you know, this kind of issue is very interesting to me.
Well, yeah,
know,
and I've written about it too. I wrote a book called Cracking the Code, and that basically the first third of the book is about, you know, the history of the conservative movement, starting with Thomas Hobbes and going through Sir Edmund Burke and right through Barry Goldwater.
You've just sold a copy to me. I'll pick up a copy of that.
Yeah, and I say this in the context of somebody who, you know, you and I are kind of the mirror opposites of each other. In 1964, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater, and I was 13 years old, and my dad was, you know, big in the Republican Party, the county party, and about 5 years ago, I think I went back and I reread his second autobiography, No Regrets, and,
mm-hmm.
or is it No Apologies? I forget one or the other. And, of course, I'd already read Conscience of a Conservative at least once. And, you know, I Barry Goldwater's worldview is very consistent. It seems to me, for, let me just lay this out, and you can go after it, or whatever. It seems to me that the main difference between conservatives and liberals really boils down to Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes was the first guy to both articulate the liberal worldview and the conservative worldview at the same time in Leviathan, and as I recall, it was 1634 or thereabouts, in which he, number one, suggested, and this is the guy who was the math tutor to Charles II, he suggested, number one, that private property should be legal. In other words, that people should be able to own things. At that time, the king owned everything. The king owned even your wife, you know, the right of the first knight and everything. And that all men were equal. These were core liberal concepts, ultimately, conservative concepts. And he also articulated the idea that on the other hand, that without a social order ordained by God, a great chain of being is how he referred to it, stretching from the divinely ordained rulers through lesser monarchs down through the landed aristocracies to peasants and serfs, without what he referred to as the iron fist of state or church controlling the behavior of individuals, because people are inherently evil, they would act out their evil impulses, and therefore we would live in a state of constant warfare. In fact, here's the exact quote from him. He said, "From equality proceeds diffidence, from diffidence war. As a result of this, there must be allowed a power of dominion over men, or else continuous war would always be the result, because humans are at their core evil." Then along came 30, 40 years ago, later, came John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who said, no, we agree with the part about private property. In fact, Locke's famous quote, life, liberty, and estate, we agree about private property, but we disagree that people are evil. We think that people are good, and therefore they can govern themselves. And that became the core of the liberal philosophy, which was adopted by Madison, Jefferson, Franklin, and rejected, frankly, by John Adams, ultimately, by John Adams and Hamilton, the original conservatives. What do you think about my take on this, first of all?
I think it's close, but I disagree with you. I actually learned from Richard Hofstadter, mm-hmm. Who wrote a great book called The American Political Tradition, that the founders were actually conservatives and distrusted people quite clearly. So let me throwing in the evil is a little low.
Well, I think, you know, anytime we say the founders, we have a problem.
Yeah, the difference between left and right, the basic difference is in the view of human nature.
Right. My point.
No, that's exactly right. The way I conservatives see, a conservative view is that the root cause of social problems is us. And therefore there are limits to what you can do to address and change society.
Right.
Because it's run by people.
And people are inherently
flawed. So it's always remarkable to, you know, that people on the left think that government can solve problems. I mean, government is responsible for slavery, for genocide, and so forth. Because the people in government are the same people as the people who are causing the problems, except that they have a lot more power.
Actually, I could argue that slavery was the product of capitalism rather than government. And government came to be the protector of capitalism, and it was one of the major forms of capital. But the bottom line point, I think,
is... The point is that slavery requires government sanction. I mean, it's got to be legal.
So does any
but
kind
anyway,
of commerce.
The basic idea is this, that Rousseau is really the fountainhead of modern leftism.
Sure.
I think the liberal label just confuses everything, because conservatives are actually liberals today. But it doesn't, it's not important. It's just it's a word that's been destroyed. It doesn't mean anything anymore. But people on the left follow Rousseau. Man is born free, but is everywhere in chains. The idea being that in the state of nature, we are, you know, cooperating creatures.
Right, that the essential nature of humans is good, and that what is corrupt is our society, our particular culture.
Right.
Right. And Hobbes was saying, no, our particular culture is...
That's obvious. First of all, you know, speaking as a conservative now, it's obviously false. People are not born free. Of course, they're born incredibly dependent. But they, an evil sort of is too strong a word, but the people have the, they're narcissistic, egocentric. You know, if you put two little, you know, 2-year-olds in a room and close the door and put some toys on the floor, within, 10 seconds, there'll be screams coming from the room. The kids will be at each other.
Actually, there's some interesting studies recently that indicate that if the kids tend to more frequently tend to cooperate than to compete.
All right. You know, it's
see, this gets back to the debate. You know, is this the conservative versus liberal world?
This is the basic debate. So if you believe that human nature is good, and also that social institutions are the force corrupting it, then changing social institutions will in effect change the nature of human beings as we see them today.
Not if you think that the nature of human beings is immutable. I would suggest that both sides think that. Can you stick around? We'll wrap this conversation up, because I'd like to bring it also into the Republican Democratic context and perhaps even Barack Obama and John McCain, because I think that their worldviews are as different as yours and mine, and probably reflect yours and mine to some extent. We're talking with David Horowitz. HorowitzFreedomCenter.org is his website. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Liberal. I'm a liberal early in the morning.
21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And David Horowitz on the line with us. HorowitzFreedomCenter.org, his website. David, let me put to you the question that essentially Thomas Jefferson put to John Adams. If you believe that the essential nature of people is evil and there needs to be some external restraining force and that they're essentially incapable, because of their essential nature as evil, of total self-governance, then how can we have a state in which people are self-governing? You know, how can we have a state in which people experience both freedom and governance?
Well, first of all, I don't accept, you know, people have a capacity for evil, you know, and some people have a greater capacity than others. But we have... The way you can have a self-governing state is, first of all, you know, what the founders did, you have checks and balances, so that it's really difficult to make big changes. I mean, I know change is the big theme of this election year, but don't hold your breath. I don't care whether it's Obama or McCain. The system is made so that you can't change it too much too fast. That's the way the founders did it. That's why, I don't know, 9 guys and gals with lifetime appointments can thwart, you know, laws that the people pass.
Sure.
That's why the Senate wasn't, you know, senators weren't elected in the beginning.
Right.
And so forth.
Well, that was the influence of the
Wyoming,
conservatives, basically.
With Wyoming, which has whatever it has. Yeah. 500,000 people, has 2 senators, and so does California, which has 33 million people.
Right.
It's not, okay, so the founders did not believe in democracy, you know, a pure democracy. They understood that there is a serious problem with people get swept up in emotion.
Well, hang on just a second. Let's acknowledge that there was actually a debate among the founders. Jefferson was very much in favor of a pure democracy, and Adams was very much opposed to it. For example, he referred to people like you and me as the rabble.
The system that we have.
But the system was a compromise between those two. I agree.
Well,
with you.
I understand that. That's okay. I knew we would. Of course. Yes. Of course. But the conservative view, which is the American system, as the Constitution was written and signed, and as it even still exists, although it's been eroded quite a bit, that's the view. The view is a distrust of the passions of the people. The 18th century had these terms, the passions and
sure.
the interests.
Do you think we should go back to an unelected Senate?
They get nutty about things. I mean, they get swept up in enthusiasms. It's like stupid things like the V-chip. I mean, we probably can agree on the V-chip. Mm-hmm. We're probably both opposed to it.
Yeah.
But Gore and Clinton got a bug, and Joe Lieberman, they all got a bug up their behinds that... ignoring the fact that the technology is so rapidly changing that this is going to be ridiculous, they had this whole idea of putting in a V-chip to block violence, allow parents. I don't know how much money was spent. I don't know, it was a big popular thing, and it passed, and it disappeared.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. But... I mean, the basic thing is whether you have a skepticism.
But here's the question, David. How can you, if you don't believe in, if you're concerned about the passions of the people, if you're concerned about the, if you're afraid of the rabble, as Adams talked about, how can you have governance?
Tom, intellectuals. Look, if you look
So you think there should be a governing elite?
Debate over global warming, you have... The 90% of that debate is conducted on both sides by ignoramuses who have college degrees and advanced degrees. All of the pundits on global warming, all of the people on talk radio, all of the people in the op-ed columns of the New York Times, none of these people are climatologists. They don't know what the hell they're actually talking about. Actually, Friedrich Hayek wrote a great article, it's called Socialism and the Intellectuals, that points this out, that our entire public debate is conducted by people who have a little knowledge. They're adept in communication skills.
Well, you could argue that the same was true of von Hayek. Economics at that time was not even considered a science. It still isn't.
Well, I don't know if you can... I mean, there are people who devote their lives to a specialty.
Yeah.
But So don't, it's not the way, you're rigging the debate. I mean, I as a conservative, I'm very concerned about the poor, about the minorities, about people at the bottom of the ladder.
Yeah, you just don't think the government is the best way to help them. I understand.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Government has been incredibly destructive.
Yeah.
To poor black and Hispanic people in this
Okay. country. David, I'm sorry we're out of time, but it's a great conversation.
It's a very interesting debate, and I don't think that...
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at
6-6-3-0-3-22-70. 4 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. See, sometimes when you see the really big picture, when you hear the large story, when you get a sense of really what the core issues are underneath it all, then a whole lot of other things start falling into place. And the liberal worldview, which is relatively recent, by the way, this is only 300 years old. In our civilization. Now, the liberal worldview is the one that you will find among indigenous people all over the world, that we can live together as a tribe, we can live together as a community, self-governance, egalitarianism. It is more common than it is rare among indigenous populations, aboriginal populations. But in what we call Western society, or modern civilization, it's actually only been about 300 years, because for most of that 7,000 years, we had the conservative notion that you had to have a king who was speaking on behalf of a god who was regulating the behavior of every single individual, or ultimately had the power to, because everybody is evil. And so you pick out, or not everybody, but the majority of people. So you pick out a few good people and have them rule, the rule of the nobility. And, you know, one of the big questions is, are people born believing, you know, born inclined to think that some, you know, that most people are evil, and others born inclined to think most people are good? It's a really fascinating topic, and nobody has really resolved this. There have been some interesting studies recently that suggest that perhaps childhood development may have something to do with whether somebody grows up to be a liberal or conservative. But then those are contaminated by the fact that that childhood development may have to do with the temperament that we're born with. Who knows? Who knows? But the bottom line is about 20-25%, maybe more or less, of the population is just, you know, absolutely grounded in the conservative worldview. About 20-25% of the population is absolutely grounded in the liberal worldview. And about half the population really doesn't understand either one and is kind of some gray area in between and can go back and forth, but tends toward one or the other. And the conservative worldview we see acted out in the authoritarianism, for example, of the Bush administration. You know, lock down, use fierce, you know, control people. And it's one of the justifications for war. You know, if most people are bad, then we kill a lot of them. If you kill a lot of them, you're probably going to kill more bad people than good people. So go ahead and bomb Iran. Right. And I don't mean to characterize David Horowitz's perspective in this. This is my perspective of the essentially conservative worldview. And conservatives would say, on the other hand, well, you know, liberals, because they think everybody is good, then they think that it can turn everybody back into being good, and therefore they want to re-terrorize their rights rather than put them in prison and torture them. And we've heard both these arguments. And the fact of the matter is that there's some truth to both these arguments. And I think that we really need to having these discussions in America. So, John in New Haven, Connecticut. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi. It's an interesting discussion. I don't think, though, that supporting the sort of Hobbesian worldview of people as inherently evil necessarily means that you got to go conservative view. And the reason I say that is because, if I remember my political philosophy correctly from 30 years ago, then that Hobbes, when he talked about the state of nature and people being evil and bad and distrustful of one another, said that, you know, when the guy went out to the field, he couldn't trust leaving his wife and family alone in the village because somebody was going to come and do bad things to him. So he and others in the village hired somebody to patrol things, basically. And that was the beginning of government, the concept being that government does for people what they cannot do for themselves.
By way of defense, yeah. I mean, here's Hobbes' famous quote is when he was asked, or not when he was asked, but in Leviathan, when he was writing about what human life must have been like before civilization. And keep in mind, when he was writing, there was very little literature about Aboriginal and Indigenous people. So this was the assumption in 1634 of how all the tribes around the world lived. He said, in such condition, without people being ruled by the iron fist of church or king, there is no place for industry because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture on the earth, no navigation nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving or removing such instruments, such things as require much force, no knowledge on the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. That's, you know, that's the famous quote from Hobbes,
right.
And it really summarizes his worldview. So,
well, and I think that the founding fathers, you know, pick up on your segment you had. The founding fathers did sort of believe that government had to be structured, assuming that people would do bad things. But that doesn't necessarily grant that the conservatives are correct. All it does is protect the field of play, so
right.
to speak.
No,
and
I think
discussion about how much government can do could go forward.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Good point, John. Thank you very much. And yeah, there's a consensus that people can behave evil. Right. I mean, there's an absolute consensus right across the board, and that some people are so twisted or deformed that they will always behave evil, or that seems to be their core nature. the argument is that the essential nature of humans coming out, or is that the consequence of a deformation caused by a dysfunctional society? Nathan in Seattle. Hey, Nathan.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Well, I
good versus evil here.
I sort of fear these arguments about human nature and saying that humans are always going to act in a particular way, like with the so-called laws of economics. And I noticed that Horowitz was a little bit hesitant to admit that economics is a pseudoscience because, you know, it doesn't predict anything accurately. I mean, there's always one side saying the market's going to go up and one side saying the market's going to go down, and so one is right, and it seems like they've predicted it, but they really haven't. And I feel like the human mind's ability to recognize a situation for what it is or recognize a stated law frees us of that so-called law. And so we are never really bound by something as long as we are aware that it's there. Like evolution, for example. I mean, it happened to us, but now that we know it's there, we can always just break the rules of what evolution says we will do.
To the extent that we, you know, yes, although there's some, you know, there's a real danger of hubris associated with that. Look at what we're doing with, for example, nuclear power. You know, we think that we can break the laws of nature, but, you know, our future generations for a quarter million years are going to have to deal with the waste that we leave behind so we can have 30 years of cheap electricity.
Yeah, certainly. I agree with you on that. But what I mean is that with economics, they'll say that a person is always going to act in their own self-interest and they're always going to try and improve their own situation.
Right.
But if you're aware of that, you don't have to follow those rules, and so they aren't really rules at all. And in this age of communication and the Internet, if everyone can be educated in the same way at the same time, we can break every rule that there is.
Well, and in fact, a lot of these rules aren't actually rules. The fact of the matter is that the first instinct of people is not to act in their self-interest. The first instinct of people is to protect their family. That is the, you know, people will die for their family, and that's the first instinct, and an extension of that or an expansion of that is the instinct that John McCain is basically running on, which is that people will die for their country, and that's altruism, which is the ultimate liberal perspective, not the ultimate conservative perspective. But anyhow, good point, Nathan. Thank you. Sean in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Sean.
Hey, hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. So what I wanted to comment was that basic belief that the conservatives have that there's something to be feared in people and that they want to control them because they're afraid of them. I think that, you know, if that's true, then they don't really trust them. What they also don't trust, actually, they don't trust that they'll take care of each other.
Right.
They say, well, you know, social services could be taken care of by volunteerism, by people contributing. But if that's true and people are not to be trusted, why are they going to do that?
Yeah, there is a certain inherent contradiction there. And looking at it from a conservative point of view, then you have the conundrum of if you don't think that people will do it and you don't think that social institutions, say corporations, will ultimately take responsibility for the problems of society or the tragedies that people experience, and you certainly don't think government will do it, who's going to do it? And this is where, you know, conservatives fall back on the, well, there's a few good people theory out there, and those few good people tend to be the ones who are basically running the churches or running the social services organizations, and therefore we'll have 1,000 points of light. We'll let the few good people do the good work. And you know, a liberal would say, no, we're all the good people, and we're all our brother's keeper, and we're all part of the society collectively, and we've got to work on this together. So
that's a good answer, Tom. What I believe, though, is that they're really operating on the idea that there isn't enough, and this is what they're afraid of. They're afraid of the fact that they have to protect what they have because there isn't enough for everyone, and that's the real distrust of the people, is that there just simply isn't enough to go around, and they're protecting their own.
Yeah, that's
what they have.
You know, I've heard that before, and I also have heard conservatives say that that's the fear that liberals have, which is why they want to tax the rich, because they think it's a zero-sum game. But I think that probably that's just one dimension of human nature. But it's an interesting point, Sean. Thank you very much for raising it. Risa in Seattle. Hey, Risa.
Hi. I really enjoyed the conversation you had with David Horowitz, but I'm kind of confused or nonplussed. If the conservatives believe that people are inherently venal, not necessarily evil, but venal,
mm-hmm.
Then why would they want to deregulate everything? Why are the banks being deregulated? Why are unions being tossed out? Wouldn't somebody who believes that all people are venal want more regulation?
That's the perfect question, and here's the answer, Risa. If you believe that people are evil, then an institution that represents the majority of the people, that has the largest number of people having input into it, would be an evil institution. That's government. On the other hand, an institution which is run by a very small group, a small elite group of good people, would be morally superior to we the people. So a corporation, which is run by a small group of people, would be morally superior to government, which is run by the majority of the people. Because it's amoral. Because a corporation has no morality, it's better than the immorality of government, which represents all of us. Whereas a liberal would say, you know, it's the other way around. Government representing all of us is inherently good, and an amoral corporation has the potential for evil. Risa, thanks for raising the question. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Well, much to their credit, yesterday I was expressing some dismay that, you know, 4, 5, 6 days of basically lies and spin coming out of the McCain-Palin camp that they are somehow different from George W. Bush has been just embraced and not pushed back on by the media and had been ignored by the Obama campaign. And much to their credit, the Obama campaign came out yesterday with this ad.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
They call themselves Mavericks. Whoa. Truth is, they're anything but. John McCain is hardly a maverick when 7 of his top campaign advisors are Washington lobbyists. He's no maverick when he votes with Bush 90% of the time. And Sarah Palin's no maverick either. She was for the bridge to nowhere before she was against it. Politicians lying about their records, you don't call that maverick. You call it more of the same.
There you go. And Sarah Palin apparently still continuing to lie about being opposed to the bridge to nowhere.
You're going to hear a lot about the abusive practice of earmarks in Congress from our good senator here. We championed in Alaska reform of the old earmark process. I told Congress, thanks, but no thanks for that bridge to nowhere up in Alaska. If our state wanted a bridge, we were going to build it ourselves.
Yeah, right. And it turns out Alaska actually gets more money in earmarks per person than any other state in the union. And that Sarah actually, when she was the mayor of Wasilla, hired a Jack Abramoff-connected lobbyist to get the folks in her town more money than any other town in America in earmarks. And she was in favor of the bridge to nowhere before she was opposed to it, and then when she was running for governor, by that point in time, the bridge to nowhere was dead. It had been replaced with a road to nowhere, which was the road that was supposed to go to where the bridge would start. And she actually was in favor of the road to nowhere. So she's still out there peddling this stuff. We'll see how much longer they keep buying it. James in Pensacola, Florida. James, convince me you're not a Republican plant.
Oh, sure. Well, on the topic of good versus evil,
yes, sir,
I'd like to comment on Palin first and foremost. Well, let me say first, I'm a progressive Democrat. I am gay. I've had a partner for 16 years, and I'm what I call a Hillary Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'm going to make some comments in support of Palin. First of all, Palin attended the Assembly of God Church, and she quit attending in 2002.
She was in that church 3 weeks ago.
And she was
in that church 3 weeks ago when Jews for Jesus were there talking about how the terrorist bombings in Israel are the result of Jews not having accepted Jesus as their Lord. There was punishment from God to the Jews for not accepting Jesus. She's also in her church, which has the Pray Away the Gay campaign, where they're convinced that gays and gay activity are just plain old nothing more than and nothing less than evil behavior, and that if you pray enough, then that evil will be washed away from you and you will no longer be gay.
But she does attend a non-denominational church, but sometimes she does go back to her childhood church, which you're referencing, God's church.
Now, you know, James, I'd suggest you go look at the internets. There's all kinds of video of her speaking before this church. I've got a bunch of it here. I'm not going to play it on the air just, you know, because it would take so much time. But, no, she's been very active in the Assemblies of God in Wasilla. Speaking as somebody who, at one brief period in my life, attended an Assemblies of God church, the North Lansing Church of God, I know their theology, and I can tell you, their theology is not something that, as a gay man, you would want to embrace. Just, you know, but don't take my word for it. Check it out. I'm serious. I'm not sure who you've been listening to, but they haven't been telling you the truth. James in Salem, Oregon. Hey, James.
I'm good. Thanks for taking my call. Before you went to the break, you were talking about the good versus evil, and I'm not sure if you've read it. I thought I heard you mention it a while back, but there's a book called Ishmael.
Yeah, Dan Quinn is a friend. In fact, he wrote a blurb for my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I wrote a blurb for his most recent book. Ishmael's a brilliant book, and as is My Ishmael and the Story of B.
And I really like the idea, you know, that the so-called savages against the civilized.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the civilized who are really destroying the world.
That's right. The takers versus the leavers, to use Dan Quinn's language. And he was stepping off work that Rhian Eisler did. And Rhian Eisler and David Lawyer are not only good friends, but I have so much respect for them and their work. And Rhian Eisler wrote this brilliant book called The Chalice and the Blade. Or is it The Chalice versus the Blade, which was one of the things that inspired Dan Quinn. In fact, in Ishmael, he puts in the gorilla's mouth the acknowledgement of that book. So there's a great lineage here, and then Maria Gimbutas before Rhian. There's a lot of great literature out there. Thanks for raising that book, James. I appreciate it. Nick in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. Hey, Nick, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I think Obama is on a trajectory, if you follow it out, even with that ad that you just played, to losing the election, and I think it's 100% certain. That ad only scratches the merest surface of what's necessary. And this actually ties into the earlier discussion with Horowitz. Obama is a nice man. We are all nice liberal people, and we don't want to go down into the, quote, gutter with the tactics of McCain, Palin, Karl Rove. They've done this twice already, and it's the same pattern repeating itself. And I put it to you, a couple of points. One, most people, even if they understand that what McCain is doing is lying about Obama and lying about their own record, if people perceive that someone is not willing to fight the lie, that they don't have the chutzpah, the courage, the guts,
I think people are getting it that Obama's willing to push back. And let me just challenge the nice meme for a moment here.
Yeah.
John Kennedy was a nice guy. And people loved him and embraced him. Richard Nixon ran as a nice guy. The Checkers speech, my wife has a cloth coat, we have this little dog, you know, all this stuff. He ran as a nice guy. Lyndon Johnson arguably didn't, and I think it hurt him. But I'd say Dwight Eisenhower actually ran as a nice guy. He ran on a peace platform. He was going to end the war in Korea.
I like Ike.
Yeah, I like Ike, exactly. So I think that nice guys in America actually can win.
Well, I'm not talking about nice in terms of surface. I'm talking about at the gut level. We think that we're good.
Obama is a wimp, consider, Nick, he took on the Clinton machine and beat them.
Yeah, but he didn't do it by taking her on head-on. He used a very sort of tactical, subtle approach. And I think that that's not going to work with McCain and with Palin. I think he's going to have to use what I call tough love.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Nick, I'm sorry we're out of time.
All right.
I get your point. I appreciate the call. Or at least I think I got your point. And I agree. They need to be pushing back. They need to be pushing back hard. I think they need to be using surrogates. They need to be using Joe Biden more for that, frankly. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Sarah Palin, John McCain, and the GOP. It's interesting, up in Washington State, you can define the name of the party that you want to be on the ticket with. And Dina Rossi, instead of saying Republican, has chosen GOP to be on the ballot. And nobody wants to say Republican anyhow. The Republican Party's platform seems to be more in line with John McCain's perspective. The GOP platform says, and I quote, "The same human activity that has brought freedom and opportunity to billions has also increased the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. Increased atmospheric carbon has a warming effect on the earth." Period. End of sentence. End of quote. From the Republican platform.
that was adopted at the convention last week in Minneapolis. John McCain agrees with that. Sarah Palin, on the other hand, says, a changing environment would affect Alaska more than any other state because of our location. I am not one who would attribute it to being man-made. So what's up here? Patrick Michaels is with us with the Cato Institute, cato.org, among other things. Arguably a climate scientist. You're a climatologist, are you not?
I believe so, yes. Been for about 30 years.
There you go. The author of several books, Sound and Fury, Science and Politics of Global Warming, Satanic Gases, and so on. You've worked with the Greening Earth Society, which was created by the Western Fuels Association, and you're a fellow at the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank.
Emphasize libertarian, not conservative, please.
Yes, sir. Yes, and I get it that increasingly libertarians are emphasizing that on this program.
Because in the political season we always get confused, and I just think that's not fair. Yeah, let's talk about what we want to talk about.
Yeah, my joke about libertarians, and you can knock it down if you want, is that libertarians are basically Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid.
That joke is so old.
Yeah, I know.
It's so true.
But it's true. Yeah, okay. Great. So here, let's talk about our atmosphere here. From the most remote measurable times up until the 19th century, the amount of thermal inertia, the amount of absolute warming of the planet seemed to be homeostatic. It seemed to be around 0.8 watts per square meter, 0.8 of a watt per square meter, and that was also about the amount of radiational cooling, and the world seemed to be in balance. And from 1880 to today, it has increased up to the point where now it's being measured at 1.8 watts per square meter, which means that we're now absorbing this extra watt per square meter that we weren't absorbing before. And here's this recent piece from Science Magazine, published by Hansen et al. The present planetary energy imbalance is large by standards of Earth's history. For example, an imbalance of 1 watt per square meter maintained for the last 10,000 years of the Holocene is sufficient to melt ice equivalent to 1 kilometer of sea level if there were that much ice, or raise the temperature of the ocean above the thermocline by more than 100 degrees centigrade. Clearly, on long time scales, the planet has been in energy balance to within a small fraction of a watt per square meter. We're now absorbing enough heat that if we had been absorbing heat at this rate over the last 10,000 years, the oceans would have boiled off.
No,
doesn't that concern you?
That's not true. I don't know where in the world that interpretation comes from.
Well, it's taking a short-term number and multiplying it by 10,000 years, which I will grant you is not going to happen in our lifetimes.
Just remember that the sun was much, much hotter, much, much hotter for much of the Earth's history, and we had an ocean. So
the Earth's 5-billion-year history.
Yes. When we had an ocean at that time, and oddly enough,
and we had an atmosphere that had no oxygen in it.
Different.
We had an atmosphere that had no oxygen in it, or very little. We had a planet on which human life, even most modern life, could not exist.
Yeah, well,
you know, only blue green algae and things that.
We're getting off into minutiae here, where we should be talking about policy, because I know you want to have fun with Obama and McCain, and I'll be perfectly willing to have fun with you with that. Let's just stop this part and say, for 95% of the last 100 million years, there was more CO2 in the air than there is now, and the planet was warmer. And that's when we evolved. So, go ahead.
I'm looking at 400,000 years of CO2 data here in this 470,000 years, actually.
Yeah, in the ice cores.
Right, in the ice cores. And it goes from a low of 200 parts per million to a high of 288.
Yeah.
And that was 340 million years ago.
Yeah.
250 million years ago, and 1,000 years ago, rather than 160,000 years ago. It never went above 300. We're now above 350 parts per million.
Right.
So I would say what you just said is not true.
No, I said for 95% of the last 100 million years, it was higher. There is
100 million years. So you want to take us back to the climate that we had when would not have been able to exist.
That's not true. The odd thing is that even in the Cretaceous, when the carbon dioxide concentration was several times higher, I've seen estimates up to 14 times higher than now, the mean surface temperature was about 8 degrees C above. And that's certainly a much greater imbalance we're talking about. But
which
we're getting off. We're
wild,
getting off the subject.
Violence, violent
let's,
storms.
Let's talk about Obama and McCain. Come on, give me a good question.
All right. So, well, here's the question. I guess you know, Obama and McCain actually seem to be in some agreements that we that you know in disagreement with you that we have a problem with the climate. And Sarah Palin is taking your position that this is not man-made. Where does this leave the Republican Party?
Whoa, don't put words in my mouth. You obviously don't read my books. The first sentence of Meltdown says the planet's warming and people have something to do with it. They don't have everything to do with it.
Okay, so Sarah Palin is a real outlier then. I mean, she's way outside the norm, the curve here, apparently.
Well, you know, I guess the problem that I have with this whole issue is it polarizes as to one side. It polarizes in the public. One side says it's the end of the world. The other side says there's nothing going on at all. And you know, Tom, you've been around long enough that the issue lies quite well in between those two poles. And if we're going to educate people and have them understand this issue, we've got to turn down the rhetoric. You can't say it's not warming up. And as a result of some human activities, not just carbon dioxide going in the air, by the way, but the way we change the surface characteristic of the planet,
sure,
that could be just as important.
That
might be an easier fix.
Although the change, for example, deforestation. But at the same time, the loss of albedo, the loss of ice in the north and the loss of glaciers is also, flipping us into this positive feedback loop.
Yeah, except in the southern hemisphere, it's going the other way around, where you have, these records don't go back very far. They go back to the beginning of sensing satellites, which is 1979 for real global records. But
right,
the southern hemisphere ice reaches record anomaly, positive anomaly in expansion a couple of months ago. It's since gone back down to about its average, but there's clearly an upward
trend. But it's not displacing dark soil. It's upward, getting deeper.
It's
going
upward,
up, not out.
It's upward trend in albedo in the southern hemisphere. And, yeah, the ocean is very black in terms of its albedo. So that is the opposite effect to what you see with the North Polar ice at the end of the summer.
So, Patrick Michaels, what's, for policy purposes, here we have...
The policy is obvious, and nobody seems to be willing to do it because it's politically incorrect.
Carbon tax.
No. Investment.
What?
Not a carbon tax.
Investment. Investment
the best,
in what?
The best policy on climate change is to have a vibrant economy because people are going to invest in what they perceive are the efficiencies of the future.
Tom Friedman's 100,000 garages. I mean, we need 100,000 Steve Jobses or 100 million Steve Jobses or whatever it is out there doing in their garages with solar
God
power.
Knows,
what,
God
what
knows
Jobs
what
did
some
in computers.
People, Tom, God knows what some people are doing. I wish I could imagine the energy technology that runs our society 50 years from now, but I can't. But I tell you, it's going to be quite a bit different. And if we impoverish ourselves, on the way, it's going to take longer for that capital to get in there. And we're doing a great job of taking people's money right now. I mean, I think you and I could probably agree that the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae was not a good idea, and that takes away capital that inflates our dollar. How is this going to help us invest in the energy technologies of the future?
It's bailing out Freddie and Fannie. It's avoiding a Great Depression is what it's doing.
I don't believe.
You're a climate scientist. Let's not debate economics right now. And plus, we're almost out of time.
Let me just tell you the differences here that I see. Yeah. Let me give you my summary. Okay, I'm going to make an assumption that I'm going to tell you that whoever becomes president is going to push for legislation for carbon dioxide limitations.
Yeah.
And Obama's will be very stringent. He'll try for 80% reductions below 1990 levels by 2050. That's a 90% reduction because we grew by 15% between 1990 and now. McCain will go for 60 or 70%, but the point is that McCain will use the climate change issue, mark my words, to demonstrate his peaceable bipartisanship, and that will be what you will hear in the State of the Union.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting because his running mate is opposed to this. He's absolutely on the other side of the issue.
Cheney and Bush don't agree on everything either.
Yeah, a little schizophrenia in the Republican Party, I guess, is nothing new. Dr. Patrick Michaels, Cato Institute, cato.org. Thanks for dropping by, sir.
Yep.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sarah Palin, sometime back, she likes Barack Obama? This was on Kudlow's show.
McCain is ahead in Alaska, but it's only 45-40 over Obama. It's a traditional Republican state. Why isn't this a bigger lead for Mac? What has he got to do up there to make sure you carry Alaska?
Now, this is before she was put on the ticket, of course.
That's a good question, and you did your homework, Larry. That's impressive. Usually, such a red state up here, it's a no-brainer that the R is going to take the cake up here. But this is a little bit different situation now, with Obama's message resonating even with Alaskans, that being change, a desire for no embracing of the status quo and politics as usual, but something different, something dynamic and charismatic. That does resonate well, that message of Obama's.
That message of Obama's, it's resonating well. Uh-oh. And so, anyhow, that's point one. Number two, I want to point out, Catholics outraged by Palin's insults. Catholics across the country continue to be outraged by Republican political politician Sarah Palin, who repeated her smear against Catholic Action. This is one of the community groups that Barack Obama was organizing. By mocking Barack Obama's service as director of community groups sponsored by the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, an arm of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and led by 8 Catholic parishes on the south side of Chicago. This is a post by Joanne98 over at democraticunderground.com. First, the Dallas Morning News lays this out and, you know, just goes through the whole thing. He raised this group from a $70,000 to a $400,000 budget, from a staff of 1 to a staff of 13 people. This was in 1998. And, quite successful. This Catholic Charities, Catholics are getting very upset that they are being ridiculed. And the Catholic Church has been for years at the forefront of community organizing, community action. I mean, one of the most powerful and aggressive groups in modern history, I would say, acting on behalf of the poor, the oppressed, on behalf of the rights of labor even, has been the Catholic Church in many instances. And this is, of course, who Barack Obama was working with in large part when he was organizing. And these guys are trying to turn it into something else. Yeah. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jeremy in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I still want to go to the
car. Jeremy, your phone is just breaking up terribly. I'm sorry. I'm going to put you on hold. Maybe Lauren can work out. Maybe it's just a temporary thing. Rich in Westland, Oregon. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The more I listen to the program about all the messages that are going around, it's pretty clear that what we're talking about here is just one big, humongous communications game. I'd like to see you get a public relations strategist on your show on a regular basis and simply break down the communication strategy that's being used by both sides and essentially, instead of debating the topics, debate the debate, if you will.
Yeah. Well, that's a good suggestion, is actually talking about. And, in fact, that's the book I wrote, is Cracking the Code, which is about how the debate happens. And the bottom line, you know, simple fact of the matter is that on the Democratic side, there has been too much discussion of the issues, in my humble opinion. And on the Republican side, you know, way too much discussion of be afraid, be even more afraid. And, you know, I wrote this piece called Dick Cheney Speaks to the Reptile Brain, or the Lizard Brain, back, I don't know, a year or two ago. A couple months later, Arianna Huffington came up with a piece that said essentially the same thing. I think, you know, the meme is out there. A number of people have written very similar things. And that is that if you speak to the base brain, if you speak to fear, you can really provoke people. You can move people over the short term. If you speak to hope, you can move people over the long term. And my hope is that the hope
that is being promoted by the Obama campaign is something that will catch fire. Brian in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing?
Just fine. What's up?
Quick question for you. I was watching the RNC debates, and I was noticing that Senator Palin seems to be very, very...
Governor Palin.
Governor Palin seems to be very, very much against the oils and the oil lobbyists.
Actually, she's not. She's good buddies with the oil lobbyists. It's just that in Alaska, you maintain political power by taxing the flow of oil and passing that money out to Alaskans. Alaskans get checks that vary from $2,000 to almost $4,000 a year just for being in Alaska.
Right.
And you know, that was one of the things that she did was she raised slightly the tax on the oil companies. But, you know, she's also in favor of letting them have more land. She's in favor of letting them drill more oil. She's in favor of giving them more leases.
That was my question, is why is it, you know, if she's so anti-Bush and all that kind of stuff.
She's not.
So wanting to drill.
Yeah, she didn't take on the oil companies. You know, basically she said, okay, you're going to pay. The price of oil goes from $30 a barrel to $140 a barrel.
Correct.
The oil companies are paying $12 a barrel to the federal government for
that
oil.
Exactly.
So their profit just went from $18 a barrel, if I'm doing my math fast enough, to $130 a barrel. And she said, you're going to give an extra few cents a barrel to us Alaskans. I mean, that's not taking on the oil companies. And at the same time she's saying that, she's saying, and by the way, we want to open up the North Shore and the North Slope, and we're going to build a gas pipeline, and we're going to hire a Canadian company to do it. We're not even going to have local labor or Alaskan labor. We're going to have Canadians come in and build a gas pipeline. It's all spin is what it is. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at
4 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And it's interesting times here. Very interesting times. And boy, do I have a buzz in my headphones. Where's that coming from? I don't know where it's coming from. Anyhow, can you hear it, Chris? No, you can't. Okay, great. Well, then we will just carry on. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see. Jonathan, Portland. Hey, Jonathan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, whatever happened to acid rain?
It's still falling.
Well, why don't we talk about acid rain instead of global warming? Because that's an important and very real byproduct of global warming. And somehow we've gone on to this strange term. Like, why don't we talk about tyranny? Somehow we've denigrated the discourse to the word evil, which is sort of in the area of mysticism.
Hmm. Interesting point. Yeah. Okay, Jonathan, I'll give you it. It is tyranny and it is acid rain. Yes. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Yes.
Can you explain to me the difference between what happened in the savings loan debacle that McCain was involved in and this bailout of our savings and loans institutions nowadays, besides the fact that the same characters are involved?
There's only a small difference, frankly, and that's one of scale. The fact of the matter is that Fannie and Freddie, well, actually, no, there is a difference. With the Keating Five and the whole savings and loan debacle, what happened was they had basically deregulated the savings and loan business, and the people who were regulating them weren't actually doing the job that they should have been doing because they were drinking the Reagan Kool-Aid. And Keating and his buddies were making piles of money and basically ripping off the people. And
yeah, familiar.
Yeah, and we the taxpayers had to come in and bail them out. It's the exact same thing that's happening right now with FSDLIC loans. Whatever you did with that cable down there on my headphone thing has blown it up. Unless you're not the guy who did it. And it's the same thing, pardon me, Flo, and it's the same thing that is happening with banks, with FDIC right now, is that, you know, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is having to go in and bail out our banks. The thing with Freddie and Fannie is a whole different thing. Freddie and Fannie was a federal agency, were federal agencies originally that were entirely federal, that were basically like giant pools of money that would be available to banks if they needed them, large amounts in bad times, smaller amounts in good times, so that those banks could then make mortgages.
Yeah, the first year fixed rates.
Right, for your basic fixed rate mortgage. And Fannie Mae was created in 1938 by Franklin Roosevelt in order to make it easy for people to get a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's there for. In 1968, in part because the conservatives had been demanding it ever since 38 when Roosevelt did it, and in part because LBJ wanted to get some of the expenses of the Vietnam War off the books, he privatized Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And by privatizing them, basically took a government institution, this giant pot of money, the debt associated with it and everything, the whole apparatus, and said, okay, we're going to sell it in the stock market to you know, anybody who wants to buy the stock. They privatized it. And once it was privatized, it ceased having as its first function the job of making sure that the banking system didn't collapse and that there was a lot of money available for people to get home loans, and started having as its first function making a profit for its stockholders, which is by law the requirement for any for-profit corporation. That's the first, your first goal is to make money for your stockholders. And making money for the stockholders was actually at odds with the public good of providing a pot of money or a pool of money, a relatively stable money, to even out the cyclical imbalances in the housing market. And so, you know, during the time that the housing market was really hot, when it was really good, when Greenspan was dropping interest rates like crazy to make things look good,
mm-hmm.
and blowing up all these bubbles throughout the late 80s and throughout the 90s, the people who were stockholders in Fannie and Freddie were making out like bandits. The stock was up over $70, Fannie's was, and they were getting, you know, dividends of over a dollar a share a year, that they only had to pay a maximum 15% income tax on, because, you know, if you make your money with money, you pay a whole lot less income tax than if you make your money by working. And you know, this is, and now we're seeing, well, that privatization was a disaster, just like privatizing Social Security would be a disaster, just like privatizing Medicare would be a disaster.
Basically, they're asking the taxpayers that pay their fair share of taxes to bail out the people that don't want to pay their taxes.
Yeah,
tired of it, Tom.
That's a good
tired
way to say
it. Tired of the media. CBS this morning said that Bush was keeping us safe in our ports when he really wanted to hand them over to Dubai,
yep.
who had something to do with the filtering of the money for 9/11.
Yep.
I mean, the media is our main problem. We have Rachel Maddow, we have Keith Olbermann, and that's only a couple
on
of
television, yeah.
voices.
Yeah, and a few voices on radio, and
right.
you know, a few of our lonely voices out here. And Flo, and the other thing that we have is you. And we have you and everybody else who's listening to this program, everybody else who's reading, you know, Democratic Underground and BuzzFlash.com and CommonDreams.org and OpEdNews.com and all the other great websites out there. I mean, there's so many, Alternet and the Co's and
we need
and,
every voice out there.
Yeah, we do. And we all need to be speaking out. Flo, I've got to move along, but thank you very much for your comments, and thanks a lot for calling in. Jeff in Tacoma, you wanted to talk about Bob Woodward's book. He's laying out some interesting things here.
Yeah, I'm sorry to totally change the subject, but
that's quite right.
He was on Larry King, and then he was on Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air. And the thing that's freaking me out, and my wife, we were talking about this, is we don't trust him. And so basically, when it comes to what he's saying about why we're winning over there, supposedly, I have a couple of choices, essentially. I wanted to get your opinion. He's saying we have this exciting new tactic, this somehow new military technology that's as much of an advance in basically targeted assassinations of al-Qaeda leaders that it's like the tank was to warfare in the past, and he's all gaga over it. And the thing that freaks me out about this is either A, Karl Rove and Bush are feeding him false information as a sort of psyops, you know, just to convince us that they're in charge and they're taking care of it, or that they actually have created special forces death squads that are assassinating people who they claim are al-Qaeda leaders
right.
with our taxpayer dollars. And that scares me about it just as much.
Yeah, they're doing that, Jeff. You know, count on it. And by the way, they've been doing that for a long time. Go back and look at what happened in Nicaragua. You know, look at what the CIA was doing, you know, back in the 80s. You know, look at what happened in Hawaii back a century ago. Look at, you know, I mean, this the United States has, and not just the U.S., by the way, we're not the only bad guys in this regard, to that extent. But it's
of course, but it's one thing when it's Shia death squads run by our people, and we can kind of go, okay, they can get away with this over there. But they are training our citizens, guys that live down the street from us, how to do this, basically political killings. Yeah. And if Sarah Palin becomes president, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Who's to say that floodgate won't be let up on all of us?
Well, and especially if it's a fundamentalist. I mean, if she does not believe in the separation of church and state, then you've got the Shia fundamentalists and the Sunni fundamentalists and the Christian fundamentalists all going after each other. Jeff, thanks for raising the issue. Your dog's getting a bit loud there. Doug in Royal Oak, Michigan. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how have you been? You're in fuego today, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But anyway, I didn't realize I was going to get on so quickly, but I appreciate that. And I just wanted to talk about the independent voter for a second, my confidence in them. We had talked back around the Florida primary and Michigan primary that if Obama was the nominee, that I thought they were going to split about 2-1. And I'm still confident that they'll split 5-4 somewhere in there, because I do have confidence that the independent voter is fed up.
In favor of Obama?
Oh, yes. And I think also, and you can comment on this, at some point he has to have a Ferris Bueller moment. He has to look at the television and just say, are you kidding me? Is this really what's going on here? Yeah. Because I really believe that once people are faced with the reality of it versus the onslaught of the commercials and stuff, I think they'll see the way clear.
Yeah. Independent, thanks, Doug. Independent is very fashionable right now. We'll see where it goes. It's cool to say, I'm independent, I'm not, but the reality is that I think most independent voters are simply people who are not paying attention. And many of them are not paying attention because they really don't have the time to pay attention. Many of them are paying attention because, they're not engaged politically. I mean, some people that go their entire lives, they're never engaged politically. We need to help those people figure out that politics actually has something to do with the quality of their life. Martha in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Martha.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Well, I talked to a person today who got a push-pull call last night. They're starting early.
Oh, really? What did they say?
They went. They pretended they were a regular survey.
Right.
Started going down through, but as soon as they found out that she was for Obama, they started into the push-pull portion. They said that, would you still vote for Obama if you knew he was a Muslim?
Really?
Really.
So this was a lot of frustrations in the last
few days building up.
Yeah.
The only way to release those and to feel better about your day is to go to your nearest office and volunteer. There's offices literally all over the country. I live in Michigan. I think we have 30 offices.
The Democratic
Party.
One
is near you. Please go and volunteer. There's so many things that you can do in your own community, and it's fun.
Yeah, well said, Martha. We had to turn our outrage into action. And you can also go over to BarackObama.com and drop $50 on him or whatever you can afford, 25, 10, 5, 100, up to 2,200, up to 2,300.
Feet on the ground.
There you go, feet on the ground. Martha, very well said. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, if you want to see our free live video stream.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Except for the drilling in the wall. The caps had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the jack of hearts.
9.5 minutes before the hour.
Tom Hartman here with you. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Victoria, I see that Campbell. What's the commander of the Alaska National Guard, Major General Craig Campbell, back in August, and on August 31st and on September 3rd, said that Sarah Palin plays no role in national defense activities, both he and Palin play no role in national defense activities, even when they involve the Alaska National Guard. The entire operation is under federal control, and the governor is not briefed on situations. Then suddenly he changed his tune, and she promoted him. Is there an association? Inquiring minds want to know.
Inquiring minds do want to know. Here's the thing, though, Tom. The American people, or a proportion, maybe enough of the American people, have decided to buy the Sarah Palin story. They've decided not to dig deep into the Sarah Palin story. They're even going to buy the Bridge to Nowhere story. And it could be enough to put John McCain over the top.
There's still 60 days to go in this election. If the Republicans were successful in turning a war hero, John Kerry, into a guy who shot himself to get a Purple Heart, I think that the Democrats can be, and that was not even the truth. I think that the Democrats should be able to be successful in simply laying out the truth of what's going on. Don't you?
They should. I agree with you. They should be able to do that. But right now, here they are. They've got John McCain, who was stolen change from Barack Obama, and Barack Obama is sitting there and letting John McCain steal change from him.
Yeah. Well, there's been a certain amount of pushing back. I mean, there have been, a couple of, yesterday I was actually saying what you're saying today. I was, kind of bemoaning the fact that it didn't seem to me like the Democrats were pushing back in any significant or serious way. And then last night came this ad that the Republicans are lying about their records, and that that there ain't no maverick here. And in fact, here's the spot.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
They call themselves mavericks. Whoa. Truth is, they're anything but. John McCain is hardly a maverick when seven of his top campaign advisors are Washington lobbyists. He's no maverick when he votes with Bush 90% of the time. And Sarah Palin's no maverick either. She was for the Bridge to Nowhere before she was against it. Politicians lying about their records, you don't call that maverick. You call it more of the same.
That sounds to me like pushing back.
I guess my question is it going to get through? And is Barack Obama prepared to say this kind of stuff on the stump? Is he prepared to be negative on the stump, which is what he may have to do?
Well, I think calling somebody out on a lie is not negative. But he is. I mean, last night on Keith Olbermann's show, he was calling him out. He was doing it in a friendly way. But I think, frankly, that's even more powerful and disarming than doing it in a McNasty way.
I agree. It is more disarming when you do it in a friendly way. But he has to do it. He has to do it in a way where the American people hear him, and he has to do it frequently.
My concern is the media are not going along. The corporate media in America, they get these simplistic storylines and they just follow them like sheep.
They do. It's fascinating. Now, however, they suddenly have realized that there's a second storyline which is interesting for them, and that's the storyline of Sarah Palin, the potential liar. And now they're following that story.
Yeah, because apparently she is. In fact, over at Think Progress, they're keeping track of the number of times that she has lied about never supporting the Bridge to Nowhere. We're at 32 right now that she's said in the last week, I guess. Ever since it's not even a week since she first laid this out. So lies. In fact, they've got this thing, lies to nowhere. 23 lies so far. And the day's not over.
And I think it'll be very interesting to see what kind of an interview she does do with Charlie Gibson. Is he actually going to ask her some tough questions, or is he going to be careful?
He's going to be careful. Charlie Gibson wants to keep his job.
Exactly.
Yeah. He knows which side his bread is buttered on. And he certainly doesn't want to have an enemy in the White House in the event that McCain and Palin actually do get elected. But Charlie Gibson, this is the problem with, quote, news people, end quote, making multimillion-dollar salaries and being stars, is that their own self-interest becomes the thing to which everything else is subordinated.
And you know, which is very different from back in the old days when reporters got paid basically the same as cops and firemen, and you know, their job was to report and everybody understood it, and you couldn't, you know, punish them by, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's, anyway.
Well, and it's very frustrating because the way this has been set up is that she's going to sit down for multiple interviews. That means that if he asks a nasty question in the first interview, she's not going to sit down for the second interview.
Well, and it also means that 90% of the interview is going to end up on the editor's floor.
Exactly.
Right. So what we're going to see is what is Charlie with ABC or CBS? He's with ABC, isn't he?
He's with ABC.
ABC, yeah. So what we're going to see is what ABC's editors want us to see. I mean, that's the ultimately the filter. And
so then we have to wonder what narrative is it that they've bought into? If they bought into the narrative of the feisty, sympathetic mom of five, including Trigg,
right,
who fought the odds.
Right. Or who are they trying to suck up to? I mean, this is like, you know, CNN right after Bush was appointed president by the Supreme Court, one of their vice presidents flew up to Washington, D.C., and, you know, the Associated Press did a story about it. He went up to Washington, D.C. to personally apologize to the Bush administration for the negative characterizations that had appeared on CNN during the campaign and to assure them that there would not happen again.
I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. So we got a half a minute here, Victoria. Any news coming out of Washington, D.C. today?
Yes, the president's announcing the troops are being deployed from Iraq to Afghanistan. Not as many as the U.S. commanders in Afghanistan say they want, but
yep,
some troops.
Exactly as I predicted. They're going to declare victory and come home.
Looks that way.
I think, and which will be obviously tremendously helpful to McCain and Palin. And, you know, it's Republicans looking out for Republicans. Gee, what a surprise. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks for dropping by, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up next, we got some folks from Canadian TV here. We're going to get into a bit of a conversation about attention deficit disorder, of all things. And perhaps its influence on the election. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Today we have in the studio a couple of folks from Canadian television, actually globaltv.com. You can check out the website over there. Rick Green is a producer and director, comedian for the past 200 or 300 years. He may be familiar to Americans as Bill, the clumsy outdoorsman on the PBS series The Red Green Show, or as a member of the Frantics comedy troupe. Hey, Rick.
How are you doing? Loving it here.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you. Welcome to Portland, Oregon. And Patrick McKenna, host of ADD and Loving It, which is this segment that you guys are putting together for Canadian TV. He's an anchor comedian, regular roles in Stargate SG-1 and the PBS cult comedy The Red Green Show. Patrick is also living successfully with ADD. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tell me about this thing that you guys are putting together real quickly, and then I know that you wanted to ask me some questions about ADHD, and let's talk about ADD and politics as well. I'm wondering if in Canada the political culture is as insanely ADD as it is here in America, that is, short attention span. But so now that I've totally distracted all three of us,
yeah.
Let's start with...
Look, cows.
yeah. Right. How many ADD kids does it take to screw in a little light bulb?
I don't know.
You know, it, can I go skateboarding now?
Yeah, exactly.
So, Patrick McKenna...
quick background on it?
Yeah.
We're doing a documentary on ADD and loving it. People yeah. living successfully with it, how it's been such a syndrome and a real negative connotation to it. And we're finding that the people, particularly in the adults with the ADD, yeah. how they're surviving, how they're coping, and who weren't labeled as youngsters with it, they were just labeled as stupid, lazy.
We've got Richard Branson, who's the chairman of Virgin Airlines, comes out and says he's got ADD. You got the guy, Jeff, I forget his last name, the guy who started JetBlue Airlines,
Ty Pennington's come out, Michael Phelps, the Olympic swimmer has come out. It's and one of the things that we're really...
That's why he keeps doing so many laps.
Exactly.
He's bored.
He's easily bored. Yeah.
He forgets by the time he gets to the end. He's like, oh, there's an end. This isn't the ocean. And he turns around and starts swimming the other way. It's the...
Right.
But one of the things that clear to me, I mean, I got the diagnosis when I was 49, 50, and reading some books, I went, oh, man, and suddenly life, a whole bunch of my past made sense to me. I said to someone, it was kind of like finding out that your left leg's 3 inches shorter than your right. And then you can go, you know, back in my high school prom when I knocked over my date who knocked over the prom queen into the punch bowl. It's not because I hate women or I hated my date or I've got issues with my mother or I'm against dancing.
It's because you weren't paying attention.
Yeah, it's because my leg's shorter. It's like my leg's shorter. So, oh, okay, so now what do I do about it? It just part of, for me, getting, this is where you fall in the classification. Right. Then I started to be able to really have some access to managing the stuff that was not working, like my taxes, and then really
hiring somebody to do it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. There were a lot of different steps. And then one of the things we'd love to hear from your listeners are people who are themselves attention deficit disorder and
have been diagnosed that way, because a lot of times you're doing self-diagnosis. And you're finding in today's marketplace, too, it's very friendly to be ADD with all the gaming that children are doing now.
Yeah.
Commercials, sound bites, everything's much faster. Much music has been very ADD-friendly.
My old friend Ned Hollowell says, we have become an ADD-ogenic society. He's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, wrote During the Distraction, or co-authored it. It really seems like that's the case. Patrick McKenna, the host of ADD and Loving It, the culture of ADD politics... America, I mean, you know, back, I was listening, it was about a year ago, I guess, going through the Nixon-Kennedy debates, looking for excerpts that I could pull out. This is a real debate. I mean, this is a series of actual debates, and they actually dealt with issues. And, you know, that was in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
exactly.
I was 9 years old when that happened. And so I've seen American politics go from the ability to sustain in the attention span of the American electorate a half a dozen complex issues at a fair level of subtlety to, demonizing John Kerry as a flip-flopper when, you know, to just soundbite.
Down to a T-shirt slogan, yeah.
Yeah, how's it happening in Canada?
Very similar, because the Nixon debate was an interesting one because it was the first time on television. So it was the introduction of that. So I think that was the education of everybody of seeing how long will people sustain their attention for these type of things. I think from there it's been exponential, the speed this has gone. And from the Canadian point of view, we certainly don't, I mean, we have an inundation of CNN and so on, so we see all your politics all the time. Ours is a little bit slower than that. We're in the middle of an election just starting up now that, we're starting to see more of the soundbite and the more of the because I said so philosophy and therefore it's true and I confirm it in the paper. So it only takes people to see a headline to suddenly make the issue true. And I think that's very ADD friendly where it's one idea and it's simple and you can, and
more ADD destructive. I would submit to you that as our society has driven our attention spans shorter and shorter, and I frankly think that television is driving this. I think our culture is driving this. I think our educational system is, in some part collapsing because it hasn't adapted to it.
Absolutely.
To the extent that this is happening, it's making it more friendly for the world of Karl Rove style politics.
But it's also eliminating a whole generation that didn't grow up with that type of speech pattern, visual stimulus. And so there's this division that's happening within it as well. It's excluding and it's including. And I think that's what's happening in the school system as well. It's the people that the society is built for the television, for all the slogans, the music and everything that ADD works for. Yet you go walk into a school, it's not set up that way.
Right.
You're all asked to do all right-hand projects with your left hand.
Right.
It's very difficult. So suddenly there's this breakdown in society that no generation is really getting a thorough information basis at all.
Rick Green.
Yeah, I'd also go further and say, that it's a very different world from when I was a kid. My dad was brilliant IQ. He never, fought in the war, never got college education. Today he'd be a university graduate. I mean, it used to be 3% of people made it to college or university in North America. It's way higher now. So the playing field is very different. You know, the debate isn't the same. Well, that's because it's no longer just the top 3% debating. There's a lot of different voices. So there's some aspect of that that I think runs through that the world itself has changed. And my sense of it is, in Ned Hollowell, that quote about that it's an ADD world, what that means is you've got to make better choices. At some point, you've got to sit there and you've got to click to yourself and go, if I turned off the television and never watched it again, the odds are in my entire life, I would never see someone stabbed or shot. If I leave this on, I'm going to see 30,000 to 40,000 people stabbed and shot in the next, whatever, my lifespan.
Which makes you more vulnerable to politicians who say, somebody's going to stab or shoot you, let me help you.
Yeah, well, absolutely. There's a hilarious story in Canada, Saskatchewan, which is kind of our version of Montana, Nebraska, mm-hmm. and Regina, quiet little town, they pick up cable TV, so now we get the American networks. So they get ABC, CBS, NBC. They happen to pick up the Detroit stations, and this is in the 70s, when Detroit's not doing so well.
Right.
So that all these people in small town Canada, well, small city Canada, are seeing American nightly news, gunfire, shots, arrest, more black kids arrested, hostage, da, da, da. The fear of crime in Saskatchewan went through the roof.
Right.
Old people stopped going out. That the society in Saskatchewan, this lovely, friendly society, was deeply affected just by imagery.
Well, it's like the Fiji adolescent girl study that was done. I forget the psychologist's name from Harvard University who did this, where she went into communities in Fiji where they had never had exposure to television. And these are people whose ancestry causes them to be somewhat stocky to begin with,
right.
You know, Polynesians. And they had, you know, anorexia and bulimia were things that were literally unknown in this culture, literally unknown. They introduced cable television or satellite television to some of these remote communities in Fiji. And
imagine.
Within 5 years, it was something like 12-13% of the girls were,
yep.
were you know, binging and purging, you know,
yep.
trying to look like Paris Hilton.
Well, how many Americans have said we were poor and we didn't know it, right? And it's
yeah.
only when you know it that your level of happiness, anyone's level of happiness or whatever they expect out of life is really...
Well, and this is one of the things where the standards have changed because,
yeah.
Again, when I was growing up as a kid, and not to sound like an old fart here, but Jackie Gleason...
Well, go ahead, son.
Jackie Gleason, you know, in the Honeymooners was a fourth floor cold water walk-up. You know, the Lucille Ball lived in a rented apartment, and they were always wondering if they could get enough money to pay the rent that month. And then, you know, in the 80s, when Reagan came along, and all of a sudden, you know, being rich was the thing, then all of a sudden the houses on TV became much more expensive. You know, there's this study on squirrels that was done some years ago, where they found that if they just squirrels tend to make the same size nests throughout a neighborhood.
Exactly.
But if they added 20% to the mass of one squirrel's nest, all the other squirrels in the community started adding to their nest. It's like some sort of genetic thing. We notice what other people are doing and
yep.
say, must be a cold winter's coming. He must know something I don't.
Yep.
And so now you look on television and you typically see a $1 million apartment or a $1 million home.
And you're looking at people now have all of this stuff and ADD just loves to collect and it ain't good for us. Because I've got a dollhouse from my first marriage. I walked.
Please beep that, Chris.
But,
16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at Teamster.com. Patrick McKenna, the host of ADD and Loving It for Canadian television, actor, comedian, regular roles in Stargate SG-1, PBS cult comedy, The Red Green Show. Patrick, living successfully with ADD.
Yeah.
You had some questions for me.
Yeah, I was wondering from a Canadian perspective what it's like down here for your students. Do they have a particular program within the school system that recognizes ADD?
Yeah, it really depends. As a society, we're confronted with two choices. One, we can change if we've got kids who don't learn the way the school teaches, which is basically what I think ADD is. I don't acknowledge it as a disability or a liability. I think it's a difference. These kids require high levels of stimulation and interaction to learn. And so we could change the schools, which is, you know, mm-hmm. one option. For example, I was in Taiwan. I saw an amazing classroom. The teacher stood, and this was all in Chinese, but she stood up and summarized the hour's lesson in about 4 minutes on the blackboard, which you can do with pretty much any hour of education. It could be trig. Not everybody's going to understand it, but you can summarize it in about 4 minutes. And then she looked out of the classroom and she said, now, how many of you understand what I said? And about five kids stood up out of a classroom of about 40. And she said, okay, great. Now you teach the ones around you. And the kids formed themselves into little groups around the ones who understood it. And as the ones who were sitting got it, they stood up and participated in the teaching.
Oh.
And you could just watch the learning move across that classroom like a wave.
Mm-hmm.
Every single kid was fully engaged. And those kids who were distractible and impulsive and, you know, ADD or whatever, they were loving it because they were participating.
Absolutely.
And the kids who were not all that out there, they were having a fine time too. Because,
well,
you know,
we're still labeling it as a remedial class, unfortunately. So you have
right.
that system where they're not going to change it.
Well, we are here too. And
are any of the politicians acknowledging anything this with their education reform at all with the current climate?
Not with ADHD. ADHD was a big fad here in the United States about 10 years ago, and it's by and large now become part of the fabric. Instead of changing our schools to adapt to our kids, we're changing our kids to adapt to our schools. We're putting drugs into their brains, right? We're changing their neurochemistry.
Now, is that something that the teacher recommends to the parent, or is there a someone in the system within the school that they can go to and say, here's a child that should be flagged?
Legally, a teacher can't say to a parent, you've got to put your kid on medication. Right. That's diagnosing, and teachers can't do that legally in the United States. Practically, though, in reality, it happens very, very frequently.
Yeah.
And, you know, the parents will the teacher will suggest to the parents. And it's basically teachers not wanting to have to deal with it or not having the resources, frankly.
Exactly. I mean, the average school class size for us is about 32 to 35.
Yeah.
Is that similar down the
We're probably on the high end of that.
Is that, yeah.
I don't know what our national
Well, we find
is.
That, you know, parents really want their kids to be number one ever since the Reaganomic era where the kids have to be number one, that they're quite willing to drug the kids. I mean,
sure.
If we're finding that if you had about a 20% rate within the school, probably, you know, 15 to 18% of them are drugged.
Well, keep in mind the history of this. You know, Benzedrine in 1935 was promoted by a guy by the name of Dr. Bradley, who's an M.D., And he called it his miracle mathematics pill. And he was traveling around to schools selling Benzedrine, and they would give it to elementary school kids. And sure enough, those kids that were taking the stimulant drug were actually getting improved math scores. And,
which is interesting, because in Canada, and again, I don't know if it's different down here, but if you take Ritalin and things like that, you really can't enter the army. Because you're one of those people that are suddenly
there were prescribed. Restrictions here in the U.S. Army for a while about that, but since Iraq, now you can enter the army even if you're a felon or a drug addict or pretty much anything. I don't mean that as a joke.
No,
it's
absolutely
kind of tragic, actually.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, this is the same kids with ADD that are probably very good at a lot of the weaponry and things that they adapt quickly to scenarios. They think outside the box. They're probably the ones that you would like to have. Working out that way, whereas the ones that are restricting them.
I characterize these kids as hunters in a farmer's world. I think that the characteristics that we refer to as ADHD, primarily distractibility, impulsivity, and a need for high levels of stimulation, are the things that would make you successful in a hunting-gathering world. You know, noticing that rabbit that's, you know, running down the road or whatever, making quick decisions. You know, when a deer runs by, you don't sit down and say, okay, the rabbit did less meat, the deer more, you know, do a risk-benefit analysis,
right.
You can't, or cost-benefit. The need for high levels of stimulation. The person who's going to be highly adaptive and succeed is the one who wakes up in the morning and says, you know, what sounds like fun is to go out there in the world where there's things that want to eat me as much as I want to eat them and find lunch. You know, whereas somebody who's very risk averse wouldn't work in that world. On the other hand, in a post-agricultural world, a post-industrial world, we start valuing put the bolt on the screw over and over again. You know, plant the rice seed over and over again. The very boring stuff, and it doesn't work well for.
Does America look on it more as a syndrome or maybe a brain style?
You know, there's a real bifurcation. There is the medical model. This is a disability. This is a disease. And then there's the it's a difference model. And frankly, I think my book ADD: A Different Perception back in '92 was one of the ones that really started that. And I've been one of the most outspoken people saying no, this is not. And in extreme cases,
extreme,
it may be a disability.
Absolutely, sure.
But by and large, it's not a disability. It's a difference. And in fact, these kids. Have a special skill set that makes them brilliant entrepreneurs, brilliant detectives, brilliant, special forces operators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you give them a high stimulation environment, good talk show hosts, whatever. You give them a high stimulation environment, they're going to succeed in it.
Absolutely.
But if you ask them to be a bookkeeper, they're going to crash and burn.
And I think if people took even the self-test just to kind of take the label away from themselves, they'll find that there's a lot of stress out of your life that goes away just by acknowledging that they might exist in your system.
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever you call it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Patrick McKenna. With Canadian Television, Rick Green with Canadian Television here, producer and director of the program. GlobalTV.com, you can get the information. And the show is ADD and Loving It. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks
Appreciate
for dropping by. We'll be picking up your calls on any topic you'd like. right after this. 27 minutes past 2.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our number, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our free video feed. Andy in Wisconsin. Hey, Andy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I was diagnosed with ADHD in first grade, and I was wondering how prone to addiction people are with ADHD, and is alcohol a danger to people with ADHD?
There is a statistical correlation between a diagnosis of ADHD and a higher probability of both alcoholism and drug addiction. The question is why? Is it some genetic vulnerability? Is it that these drugs, crank up levels of dopamine or push down serotonin or whatever it may be? Or is it that people who are easily bored are, easily entertained by things that alter their states of consciousness? I don't think anybody definitely knows Rick or Patrick.
Well, there's been a study done where sometimes people have been taking cocaine on ADHD. Sometimes they find they don't get high on it. It actually levels them off because there's a focus. Yeah, there's a focus element to that. And sometimes with the alcohol, there's the dulling effect that slows you down. And sometimes that helps for people who are overstimulated.
So these are like clumsy effects at self-medication.
Exactly.
Andy, thanks a lot for the call. Fascinating stuff. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Wait a minute. Let me got to get the speakerphone. Just a minute. Okay. Now, got it. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Okay, right. You came up with the proper solution, and the solution is group learning and group tutoring. But what I'm saying...
Yeah, it's called peer teaching, actually.
Peer teaching is the solution. And to a large extent, the reason that it's not happening very much is it's a religious conflict, is that the people who believe in one God overall, dominating all of us, don't want group education. But I've got a slogan for the age which says, unless you first have a society in which people talk to each other, your politics are irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And we are watching television 4 hours or more a day, and the average person talks to their husband or wife about 20 minutes, much less your neighbor. And the idea of peer teaching has to be applied to the entire society. We have to do community organizing to get people away from the television and into some kind of conversation with each other, because we can't change the politics of this country if everybody is glued to the tube.
Yeah, excellent point. Excellent point, Lawrence.
By the way, just about ADD?
Yeah.
I just Googled attention deficit disorder plus television.
Yeah.
And I got 359,000 results.
Yeah.
One guy just would take them all up.
And it said, it's official, TV is linked to attention deficit babies and toddlers.
Yeah. I wrote a chapter about this, thank you, Lawrence, in my latest book on ADD, which came out about 2 years ago, called The Edison Gene. And it even goes beyond that. There's a fascinating set of studies and some really startling science that Joseph Chilton Pierce, the guy who wrote The Crack in the Cosmic Egg back low many years ago, and I wrote the foreword to the new edition of it, laid out in his book Evolution's End and some of his more recent research, that when the baby's developing in utero, it is constantly interrogating the mother, is the world out there safe? And the mother's constantly feeding back to the baby whether or not the world is a safe place. And if the feedback that the baby gets, and this is all biochemical, if the feedback that the baby gets is that the world is a safe place, then the forebrain, the neocortex and the thinking part of the brain gets an exaggerated level of development. And the hindbrain, the reptile brain, the lizard brain, the fight or flight brain, exactly, is diminished physically. I mean, there's an actual physical difference. On the other hand, if the mother is feeding back that the world is a dangerous place, then the hindbrain is overdeveloped. People become more instinctively violent and fight or flight. And the forebrain is diminished, and cognitive abilities are actually diminished, the ability to think and to reason and consider things. And the chemical that mediates this is cortisol. This is a hormone that the body is produces in response to stress. And where it gets real interesting is that we know that stressful situations, stressful jobs, divorces, deaths, things like that, you know, spike cortisol sometimes for days, sometimes for months. But what was particularly interesting was a study that they did where they were doing continuous blood monitoring of cortisol levels. In other words, they put an IV in somebody's arm and they're just like every 10 minutes or so measuring the blood that's passing through it. And they found that when a pregnant woman, and they did this with pretty much everybody, and it's right across the board, but it's of particular relevance with pregnant women, is in a room with a television on, even if the sound is not on, because the screen is refreshing 30 times a second, that flicker is interpreted by the peripheral vision, which is fast enough to actually detect that flicker, as movement on the perimeter, which produces an increase in cortisol levels to increase alertness because it may be a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so simply being in a room with television increases blood cortisol levels, which increases the probability that the baby that's going to be born is more fight or flight and less cerebral.
And also that feeds into the genetic responsibility of ADHD, because you have that woman who's feeling and sensing life that way, sending those signals to the baby. So the genetic correlation seems to
Patrick McKenna. And then there's also the whole issue of genes. You know, we used to think that genes were simply on or off. You know, okay, you've got brown hair because you've got genes for brown hair. And most of the genes in our body are basically on or off. But there are also genes that could be turned on and off by environment. You know, I have a gene for celiac disease. I got turned on when I was 50 years old by getting food poisoning, which is a not uncommon thing. And that gene is now on for the rest of my life. I can't eat wheat. And you know, there's a lot of things like that, and they're discovering more and more of them. And you just wonder, we're apparently far more adaptive than anybody ever thought, you know, genetically,
well,
biological.
Well, the brain certainly is incredibly adaptive.
Rick Green.
The plasticity, brain plasticity is telling us all kinds of things. And a study I recently read said that just having an adult television show on in a room or the next room to where a child is playing reduces the amount of time they play with a toy by 50%.
Amazing.
Like we are just unable to sit for lengths of time. I bought my kids Lego. I bought them Kinects. I bought them all these sit and build toys. My son just had real trouble doing the TV, and I realize now the TV was on.
We had Louise and I, when we were raising kids for, 16 years, 17 years, maybe 18 years, Louise, we had no television in the house, literally, zero, none. We didn't have in the house. Patrick in Northampton, Mass., listening to WHMP. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. What's on your mind?
Not much. Actually quite a bit. Brain
cramp. Your ADD.
okay, you just gave yourself away, Patrick.
No, well, I used to work for the Department of Mental Health here in Massachusetts, who started the whole deinstitutionalization thing, and I was part of the Bruce Dukakis consent decree, you know, the whole nine. And I've been like, you know, kind of a partial but impartial observer on the whole mental health thing in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the worst thing that has ever happened to it is when people figured out they can make a career and make a living out of this.
So your point is that as long as there's a profit motive in mental health, then
there's no cure.
You're right. You have the same problems that you have in physical health, which is that you have an illness industry rather than a healthy industry, a wellness industry. Excellent point. Patrick McKenna, Rick Green, how does Canada deal with this?
Well, we have socialized medicine, so it goes on forever. there's a lot of help, and there's a lot of outlets, which is great, because people aren't intimidated by the dollar sign, whether they can ask for help. So that is there, and that's been a wonderful benefit.
But the resources for children are actually much less than in the United States. And for adults in Canada who are being diagnosed, and that people are starting, especially when the kids are getting diagnosed, they go, oh, that sounds awfully familiar.
Yeah.
And that's how Patrick first realized. I suspect that's probably how I first noticed.
Well, that was my experience, you know, sitting with my son 15 years ago when, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, that sounds like me, too.
Yeah.
Mike in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Well, the question was partially answered with the discussion about in utero stimulation. But I was wondering if there's any hard research as to how the television and the quick sound bites and scene changes affect the development of children.
Yeah, that's
producing ADHD.
Yeah, with regard to ADHD, as far as I know, and thanks for the call, Mike. As far as I know, with regard to ADHD, the jury is out. Nobody is, but the development of, for example, you know, the cortisol, forebrain, hindbrain. I mean, that research is pretty definitive, which is why I put it in my book, Edison Gene. Even though it wasn't specifically about ADHD, it was about the adaptation to culture. I don't know.
But Rick had an interesting stat a few years ago about the development of. What they knew 20 years ago for ADHD, what they would be prescribing would now be considered malpractice because it's such an right. ongoing process. We know so little, and it's every day it's unfolding.
My sense of ADHD and ADD in adult version, is that on some aspects it's probably more than one thing. That's what I'm hearing from the people we've talked to, the researchers who seem to be on the edge of this. The sense also that there are a lot of people who are very well functioning. There's three in this room right now. There's probably more because they're a television crew. So there's a lot of there are people.
Oh, this is a radio building. It's
right,
full of us.
It, sure. But there's also there are people out there, and it's not to dismiss it. There are some people struggling. Like
sure,
I've met some, and they're struggling. So and it is a medical issue for them. And I can look at that and go. My sense is that it's not unlike. And this is stretching it, but it's a little bit like how we were about depression 30 years ago. Mm. That's just women. That's just midlife. They grow out of it. You're just weak. You're just a coward. You got to smarten up. So get some perspective. Mm-hmm. And then the research started to show, compare the brains.
There's a new book, it came out 2 years ago, actually, about Abraham Lincoln and mm-hmm. his depression. And it submits that the thesis of this book is that he would not have been the brilliant president he was, and he would not have been able to lead us through a war successfully, a civil war, and keep this country intact if he had not suffered from severe cycles and bouts of depression.
Right.
And you could say the same thing about Churchill. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270. David in Orange County, California. Hey, David, welcome to the show.
Oh, my God, this is such a pleasure. I've wanted to talk to you for, dear Lord, 3-4 years now.
Well, thank you for calling.
Fascinating discussion about this ADD. I'm 47, will be shortly. My wife and I, who is my high school sweetheart, we noticed something in myself when I was 26, and we started our own business. And I said, you know, this something's wrong. It's like my mind is in a fog constantly. And I apologize. I'm a little nervous talking to you. So, long story short, I went and got involved in a clinical study about attention deficit disorder. It was brand new. It was about 88. Mm-hmm. And they gave me Ritalin. They didn't know much. And the Ritalin for me was amazing in the sense that it opened my mind. And I told my wife, it's like now I know what it's supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. A year and a half, 2 years at the most, I took the Ritalin, got off of it, and never had gone back ever since. Mm-hmm. In high school, I was a social butterfly. Didn't do anything. How I graduated is still a wonder. But I read 2 books my entire time in high school. In the past 8 years, I've probably read about 300 books, all current affairs, stuff that you've recommended. I've become very political and what have you, and as a result, I've learned how to do these things, and I'm just telling anybody that's out there, if you can get help, do it.
And it's a world of difference. And that excellent point, David, and thank you for calling and making it. I appreciate it, and it's great to hear from you. The idea of Ritalin as training wheels, I know so many people who have done this. They go on medication for a short period of time. They figure out new behaviors. They develop new behaviors, mm-hmm. and then they no longer need or feel that they need to take the medication.
That's what I was going to ask David.
Patrick McKenna.
I was going to wonder if David, if he's still on the line.
He's not.
But I was just wondering if people are, when they're on Ritalin, if they take the opportunity to develop those practices.
That's the key to it.
It really is. Not to just take the Ritalin and assume that's going to make everything better. It's while you're there learning. Organizational skills, and then maybe you can.
And that's what Freud was promoting, by the way, during the 7 years that he gave 100% of his clients cocaine. back, you know, from 1901 to 1908, as I recall, were the years that he was.
The good years, as his clients called it then.
Yeah. He wrote a book of love poems to cocaine. I mean, his daughter Anna wrote the cocaine papers. That's all his writings on it.
And again, I've been traveling around doing a lot of interviews with experts.
Rick Green.
And one of the things that has become very clear to me is that the Ritalin is a weapon in the arsenal, but it does nothing on its own except stop the symptoms. It's like, right, eating healthy. It's not going to turn you into an Olympic athlete. But you couldn't become an Olympic athlete unless you're living eating, right, healthy. So it does provide a foundation for people, but it's then there's a lot to deal with after.
Right. And it's a stepping off point. Excellent point. Ariel in Charlottesville, Virginia, listening to WVAX. Hey, Ariel.
Hi, it's Ariel.
Ariel, I'm
pleasure
sorry
to speak with you.
Thank you.
I love what the last guy said about Ritalin. I was diagnosed as an adult when I was around 40, except I have continued to take it because it just doesn't work without it, but I take very, mm-hmm, low dose.
Yeah.
As a kid, I was told I was lazy, I was an underachiever. I actually never did finish high school,
mm-hmm,
but I went on to college, and I have college degrees now. The other side of it is ADDers, first, we all have a great sense of humor, and we recognize each other, and we laugh at each other's foibles.
Yeah, Robin Williams is the poster child for this.
Yeah.
Although I don't know that he's acknowledged it. But
I agree. And the other side of it is my ability to hyper-focus.
Mm.
When I need to get something done, my wife pointed it out before the diagnosis, my kid could stand there and be yelling at me as I'm sitting there reading something, and I wouldn't hear him.
Yeah, yeah.
That's... And the other thing, I have a psychiatrist, and my meds are very controlled, and it's very low dose. When I first started getting the right dose, I told him, I take a 5 milligrams of Ritalin, and then I go take a nap.
I know people adults who take a 5 milligram tablet for the day. They'll break it into quarters, and they're taking 1.5, 2, 3 milligrams. They're titrating down. And what I find so tragic is, I know so many psychiatrists, and actually it's the GP docs who do this more often, who try to titrate up. They'll give 20 milligrams right off the bat, or 30 or 40 milligrams, 10 milligrams three times a day. And when the person says, wow, I'm wired, this is, they say, oh, well, it's double the dose.
Well, no, I actually, he told me I could take up to either 60 or 80 milligrams, and I finally told him,
whoa,
no.
Yeah.
This is,
yeah,
what I want to take. This is how I want to take it. And he said, okay. And I,
yeah,
said, it's that easy?
Go.
He said, adults self-medicate. If I take too much, I get shaky. I feel bad.
Yeah. Excellent point.
So, yeah, and then I take a break every year. I take a couple weeks off just to prove I'm not addicted.
There you go. Ariel, thanks a lot for the call.
Keep up the good work.
Yeah, you too. You too. Rick, you wanted to...
Well, I take a longer-lasting version called Concerta. It's 8 to 10 hours. And for me, I'll be honest, I don't drink. I've had 10 beers in my life. I've never smoked a joint. So for me to get on something was a step.
Mm.
But for me, it's like the best cup of coffee in the world. It actually, what I found was it made me more me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that, once I had that, then it was, okay, now I can go and start laying the foundation of what I want to do.
That's interesting. We have just a minute here to wrap up the show. Maurice in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Maurice.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I wanted to know if you had done any studying from the Dr. Howard Gardner. His name is Dr. Howard Gardner. He's a
Howard. The seven intelligences, seven types of intelligence.
Yes, indeed. And I think, well, personally, I feel as though schools more than anything should be concentrating on engendering the love of learning from children.
Yeah.
That's the primary thing. And everything else falls into place. And also, had you done any studying from Dr. Theodore Sizer, who basically reflects what you were talking about in Taiwan, where his whole premise is that you give students an objective and you,
right,
allow them to fill in the blank.
Right, and let them learn at their own speed. I'm not familiar with Sizer's work, but thanks for bringing it up, Maurice. It's a good one. Patrick, and thanks for the call. Patrick McKenna, Rick Green are with us. You guys are putting together a TV show for Canadian television called ADD and Loving It. And the reason they're here is because I'm going to be in it. So we're going to go off and do some videotape here as soon as we get off the air. Thanks so much for being with us today. Tomorrow, coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, Terry Jeffrey, CNS News, here to talk about the news of the day through a conservative lens. And, of course, I'll supply the liberal part. Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Michelle Dresbold of Sex, Lies, and Handwriting. We're going to talk about Obama and McCain's handwriting. Bruce Williams dropping by with breaking news on Sarah Palin's, shall we say, church problem. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.